the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Because when them old boys raised on shotguns, we say grace, we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. We can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land.
a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
God's name is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Buddy, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazoozradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html where you have access to not one, but three separate chat rooms. So, the Mad Science Show is live. Heat and cold, free energy now? Question mark. Anyway, if you jump over there in the chat room, I posted videos and pictures and stuff, links to them, so that you can check them out and see what it is that I'm talking about. The first picture that I posted in there, if you happen to be in the chat room, want to click on it, I'll explain this Peltier Element Energy Transfer System that I drew up in paintbrush on my junky old XP computer. Anyway, if you're looking at this particular picture, you're going to note that there is a hot side and a cold side. And sandwiched in between there is a Peltier element. A Peltier element, basically, when you put a charge to it, it causes one side to get hot and it causes the other side to get cold. Now, there's a process out there that they call the Seebeck effect, where you take two dissimilar metals, and as long as there's a temperature difference at the end of each of these two dissimilar metals, you'll actually get a current flow. How much current flow depends on certain factors in there, but nonetheless, when both sides of them eventually equal out, like let's say the two wires become the exact same temperature, then the process will stop. And it's one of the reasons why some people believe that thermal electricity is really inefficient, because you got to have that constant temperature difference. But nonetheless, let's talk about this anyway, because we're going to do a thought experiment. In this particular diagram that I've drawn up here, if you look, you'll note that there are two heat sinks that run into two separate containers that basically are going to not have to use electrical pump. It's going to use thermal siphoning in order to cause the circulation, which doesn't take much to a temperature difference to cause circulation. And this is one of the keys that I'm trying to get to eventually, is that we know how energy travels. We know how hot travels. We know how cold travels. We know in which direction they travel. We know which materials they travel best through, and we know which two materials combine of all the different types of materials, which ones get the best effects and such. Well, somebody took this concept and they put it into what is known as the Peltier element. The Peltier element you can find in things like igloo coolers, or you can find in different types of heating and cooling devices that run off of 12 volts DC electric. Anyway, basically when you put energy to this thing, it uses the Seebeck effect in reverse. It's one thing about science, if you pay attention, if it works one way, it'll work the other way. You know, like you blow up a balloon, the pressure will come back out the other end that you blew it up in if you allow that pressure release. So it's for every action is an equal and opposite reaction. I blow the balloon up, I let it go, and all that pressure balances itself back out. That's what nature does. Nature balances itself back out. Whether we're talking about batteries or water levels or temperature differences or whatever. And eventually, both sides will become the same temperature when they're in the same system. So, with this particular diagram that you're looking at, you're putting power into the Peltier element, which is causing one side to get hot, and heating up that heat sink, which is heating up the liquid, and creating an actual thermal siphon. So, where the cold water difference is at the when the liquid's like at its natural room temperature or such, the hotter that liquid gets, it's going to create a actual current flow of water. So the hot to the cold, so you'll actually get the water to circulate itself until the temperature in the water matches the temperature in the heat sink that is being generated by the temperature of one side of the Peltier element. On the opposite side, the same effect is going on, except we're talking about cold. When the temperature of the cold water gets to the temperature of the cold side of the Peltier element, that side will cease to circulate as well. So now you got a basic concept of how this is all going on. See, essentially what we just did, when we plugged in the power source to the Peltier element, we produced a hot side and we produced a cold side. We just took the DC electric and transferred that energy from one form to another. Now we have basically heat and cold. Cold is merely the absence of heat. But nonetheless, one side is cold and one side is hot, which maintains until those temperatures change. In the hot side and the cold side will maintain a temperature difference that in turn, when you take the power away from the power input, will now have a temperature difference going in the opposite direction, which will cause the Seebeck effect to reverse in polarity, so to speak. Sends it back the other direction. It's like blowing up the balloon and storing that pressure and then releasing that pressure out the end of the balloon that you used to blow it up with. So, with that said, now we just basically made a storage unit, the equivalence of a battery. You basically just took one form of energy, transferred it to a separate form of energy, and stored that form of energy into this system. And until it is able to equalize itself back out, until the temperature in the hot side and the cold side become even, then you will have stored energy potential in this system. Now imagine if you had each one of these hot sides and cold side was designed like the old style thermoses that when you put your coffee in it or your cold drink, that for longest periods of time, that thermos would actually hold in the temperature because it's not allowing any kind of energy exchange from the outside. See, we have all types of materials out there for insulation factor. In some of the insulation, I guess most all, I guess, there's a R factor. I can't remember what the R factor actually stands for. I have to Google it up because, you know, with a brain like mine, it's hard to keep track of everything and try to remember what it is, the terminology that I want to use. So I'm trying to explain this in the simplest possible way. But if you got something really super well insulated, a heavy-duty R factor will actually keep out it won't allow an exchange. See, it's kind of like the triple pane glasses or double pane glasses that have a little void in between there. There's no way for the energy to be able to transfer through there. It's the same thing that applies with electricity. Until you turn that light bulb on, you don't give the energy a path to go to the other side from one negative plate to the positive plate or vice versa. You don't allow a path for that off-balance plate to release its energy into the other plate. So that means your battery will stay charged until some force actually gives it a path to be able to drain out. And so once you turn your light bulb on, now there is a path for that energy to flow from one side to the next. So what you're looking at in this little diagram right here is literally a way to store energy potential that started off from a chemical battery or whatever type of battery you used that produced a direct current, which, you know, direct current flow in one direction, DC. And until you put that DC current to that, the system was balanced out. Okay, yeah, there you go. Thank you, Stephen. The R value is the measure of thermal resistance. Okay, I don't know why I can't remember that, but it just drives me nuts. Resistance. So basically, the insulation, there's different types of material that insulate better that will resist any change in temperature from one side to the next. And so what you're looking at in this particular deal, imagine each one of these, the hot side and the cold side being a thermos, and they got a really high R factor because of the way that the glass and the air barrier in between there and the whatever materials that is made, and then the outer metal shell or plastic shell, whichever the case may be in your particular thermos. But nonetheless, it has so much resistance that will keep the outside temperature from changing the inside temperature. So as long as that that heat is trapped inside that thermos, then it will remain hot until it finds a path to actually transfer the heat from one side to the next. The same on the cold side. Heat and cold both work the same way. Everything in nature, once again, is trying to balance itself out. If it's cold outside your house, then nature wants it to be cold inside your house. And the moment you open the door and let all that cold air in, then that's when it will balance itself out, and it will be just as cold inside as it is outside. Vice versa, if it's hot outside and it's cold inside, and nature wants the inside to be equal to the outside, once you open the door and let all the cool air out, then you have is just as hot outside as you got inside, and thus forth the effect stops. Nature's balanced itself back out. So we got this knowledge right here on how that actually works. If you can continuously maintain a temperature difference and store that temperature difference, then you literally have the potential of a free energy device. Flat out, you know, no matter where the energy came from on either side. If you actually look at some of the next videos that I posted in there, they will explain different types of air conditioning or different types of refrigeration. One of which is a mechanical that needs a pump to pressurize a gas and cause it to get hot, and then run it through a system that will take and cool it down and have that cool air actually change the difference inside your refrigerator. The other one is that it doesn't use a mechanical, but it uses a heat source, whether it be an electrical element or a flame. Produces the same, pretty much the same deal. All we're talking about is heat and pressure and temperature difference in order to be able to either heat your food or cook or cool your food. Excuse me. Okay, so what you're looking at here in this particular diagram is a battery. It's a storage unit. Same thing like a capacitor, same thing like a lead acid battery or any other type of energy storage. You got temperature differences and you got pressure differences. So with that said, until there's a path, then this system will store that energy until there's either a leak in the system, which means that the R factor, the resistance value or something, breaks down, and suddenly, the temperature difference outside begins to slowly change the temperature difference inside. So with that said, we find temperature differences all over in nature. The temperature difference between the sun, the temperature difference between the water, the temperature difference between different places that water travels, like obviously a spring, like in a spring-fed lake, would have a colder lake temperature than a non-spring-fed lake, maybe one that's just fed by a stream, and after sitting there and the water not running for a while, the sun would raise the temperature up and balance it up as much as it can. But fortunately for us, the water don't just sit there and boil, because we have air that is actually blowing over that water and taking away that temperature. The temperature difference between being directly in the sun and being in the shade, the temperature difference between the outside in the atmosphere and underneath a compost heap where materials are rotting and releasing energy, which in turn releases produces heat that can be utilized to heat water up. So there's all kinds of different ways in which we can actually maintain a temperature difference. Now keep in mind that with a thermocouple, a thermal pile, or even a Peltier element, for example, when both sides of a Peltier element get to the same exact temperature, then the process stops. So if you get a Peltier element too hot, it will literally heat both sides of it and the process will fail. That's why you note that on these particular devices, such as the coolers, that on one side it will have a heat sink with a potentially a fan on one side, so that it will maintain that temperature difference and not allow both sides to become the same temperature. It actually uses the fan or the heat sink to take the heat away from the Peltier element on that one side. Once the process, like I said, once both sides of the Peltier element become the same temperature, the process stops. Nature has balanced itself out. All you have is a hot Peltier element that will continue to rise in heat until it finally destroys itself. The thermal couple and the thermal pile, both the same thing. As long as there is a temperature difference between the two dissimilar metals, then the process will remain. But once the two dissimilar metals, because of their different molecular structures, they aren't that far apart that when you start to heat one up, one will take just a little bit longer to finally heat up the same temperature as the other. So there's where you get a minor voltage that is being produced by the two dissimilar metals. But once it gets to a certain temperature, once again, it becomes inefficient and suddenly the process stops. So a method that would literally keep both sides at a constant temperature difference, there's really actually no limit to where you can actually push it, as long as you know that they always have to maintain that temperature difference. The two sides can never reach the same temperature. So if you had, let's say you had a compost heap, give me a second. Let's say you had a compost heap, and underneath this compost heap you had a black hose, and you were actually circulating water through this black hose, just not using a pump, but just using a thermal siphon. There would be a temperature difference in your container, and when the temperature of the rotting compost heated up the water, the heat would begin to create a circulation from hot to cold that would eventually balance itself out to the actual temperature of underneath the compost heap. And once that temperature made it to that point, the process would stop. There would be no thermal siphon any longer. Both sides are balanced out. But what if you could take that same process and have a system that would cool down the side that was actually being circulated back into the tank, hot to cold? So out there in the air, you got a temperature difference that is different than the inside of the tank and the inside underneath of the compost heap. And so if you could regulate to some extent this energy transfer to allow some of this heat to disperse into the atmosphere, it's still hot, but it's not as hot as it was, which won't allow the temperature to ever find its balance. Both sides can never meet the same temperature. So as long as nature can never find the balance, then you will always have the same effect, hot to cold. It's going to create a current that was going to keep this thing going until that balance is achieved by nature. Till both sides of the system become the same temperature, you get the same effect. And so, knowing this, and knowing that there are, the bottom of the well, obviously probably going to be a lot cooler than underneath your compost heap. So maybe you could use this thermal siphon to literally use the temperature difference to pump water out of your well, using the temperature up underneath the compost heap, which is trying to heat the water in the system and trying to circulate that water from hot to cold. So it's a thought experiment. And until anybody actually puts this into, you know, actual a physical work or whatever, then that's what we're calling it. It's a thought experiment. But nonetheless, the same thing still applies. Until nature balances out those two temperature differences, that you will continuously have this reaction. Some of the nuclear power plants have a backup system that basically uses this same process, a thermal siphon, in order to, in case that the electrical goes down, that it will use the temperature differences to literally be able to still continually recirculate water, cooling water through the system until both sides balancing out. And so you're kind of racing the clock unless you've got the system perfectly designed to where they can never balance themselves out. Eventually the temperature on the one side is going to transfer to the other side, and when that occurs, then you're no longer circulating cold water. You're actually it's all hot on both sides, and the process stops. So in the air conditioning and the cooling portion of it, it's kind of crazy that people haven't figured this out. When you compress air, a gas or whatever, when you compress a gas or a liquid, you know, well, like I say, you can't compress a liquid, so you got to boil the liquid first to turn it into a gas, which would be steam or vapor or whatever. But when you compress that, it produces heat. And so when you have this compressed air, like inside of a can of CO2, there is a temperature difference inside there now, because this gas is under pressure. And if you ever notice that when you release a CO2 canister rapidly, you actually see frost build up around the hose or the outside of the can or whatever, because this sudden instant release of pressure is causing a temperature difference that is actually producing the opposite of heat. The absence of heat is cold. So that's what you get. So now we got this basic concept of how heat and cold we already know how heat and cold travels. We know that these two are going to want to balance themselves out. And we know that there are certain materials that if you maintain a temperature difference and these are in contact with each other, will try to exchange electrons and produce an electrical current. That's how the Peltier element works. That's how the thermal pile works. Looks like I got somebody trying to call me here. Hello, you're live. Whoever called. Yeah? No microphone? Looks like it's Thomas. Hi, Thomas. Can you hear me? I can't hear you yet. Anyway, so as I was saying, if now that we know that heat, pressure, temperature difference, we can get certain reactions by boiling water and then allowing that water to pressurize the steam pressure and then allowing it to expand rapidly, we can get a cooling effect. That's essentially the easy way to explain on how... Man, somebody called me and then they hung up. Alright, we can get the easy way to explain on how air conditioning works and heating and cooling. All we're doing, there's heat pump systems out there, all we're doing is transferring energy from one place to the next. And by using heat, we can actually absorb other heat as we're transferring that heat from one direction to the next, and we can take radiant energy off of objects and move it away from that object and cause that object to be cold, because it's wanting to travel from hot to cold to heat, whatever. Yeah, burn it. Got me all distracted. Somebody call and hang up. What kind of deal is that, man? Must be a prank phone call live. Alright, so I'm probably not explaining this as good as I want to be explaining it, but if you can figure out these two concepts, we know that we can literally take the sun and we can heat objects up extremely. And we know that under certain pressures that water will actually boil faster under lower pressures than it will under higher pressures. Which makes common sense, because if you're compressing on something, it takes a lot more energy to cause it to move around. But under a lower pressure, like say maybe all the way to the extreme of a vacuum, then everything's all stretched out and loose already. So it's easier to shake those molecules around. So we could use the sunlight to literally produce heat that could boil water, that would in turn make pressure from the water vaporizing into steam. That's the, that expansion of that release of that gas would pressurize the container, and then that, that same container could then be in turn allow that pressure to instantaneously release into an expansion chamber or cooling system that would actually produce heat or produce cold from heat. I hope y'all follow me right now. So it would be a lot easier if I had a couple other geniuses with some terminology in here to join me. But after having Skype troubles, computer troubles or something. But nonetheless, if you look in like motorhomes, that's what I'm trying to say. Motorhomes have propane refrigerators and propane air conditioners in there. And see, the older style ones basically had a compressor that did the same job. That all you needed was that pressure to cause heat, to cause an expansion, to cause pressure, to cause a circulation of the gases or mixture of gases that they use inside there to cause a temperature difference and the expansion and contraction of everything, releasing the energy into a cold system, all that kind of stuff. Alright, well, also I put a video in there, and don't do what this man did, because that's kind of ridiculous. He should have put that cup of gas on a long stick just in case. You know, always practice safety first. But literally, what he was trying to show people is that you wanted to find out whether or not boiling gasoline would cause a fire or an explosion, whether you could get the gasoline to ignite. Let me try to explain this. Anyway, what he did was he took a pan and a Pyrex container, filled the Pyrex container up with gasoline, and then put it down into the pan and put the pan on top of a hot plate and started to boil the gasoline. Well, the reason why there was no explosion during this process was because of two concepts. You had the heat going on. The gasoline was actually boiling, but there wasn't an ignition source such as compression ignition, which would be pressure allowing it to cause it to pop, or either an electrical or an open flame. Because all what was happening here was he was literally boiling the gas into a vapor, which in turn escaped into the atmosphere. Now, had he been boiling that and then hit a match or a spark anywhere near that general vicinity, then all that vapor would have ignited into a big fireball, so to speak. And when he was pouring it with his hand, he basically boiled it all down to where there's just a little bit of sludge down in the bottom of the deal, and raised the temperature up really high, and then decided it would be a good idea to pour gasoline on there to see if the temperature of the container would actually cause an ignition. What he ended up getting was an effect that basically shattered the glass. See, way back in the old days, if they wanted to get rid of a big giant boulder in the yard, they'd build a giant fire around this giant boulder in the yard, and they'd get that object really, really hot. And then suddenly rush in with pour water down a pipe or whatever to dump cold water on this pipe would cause an instantaneous expansion and contraction and literally shatter the boulder into rubble, which probably wasn't a really safe idea, because even if you watch this little video and you see how that glass shattered the moment that he poured that cooler liquid onto it. He should have known, being into science, that was actually going to happen. And safety-wise, he should have took more precautions whenever he was pouring this gasoline over the top of an electrical appliance. Lucky for him, there wasn't no open sparks or open flames. Lucky for him, the temperature wasn't so hot that the material was actually had a little bit of fire going on it, like you'd see a piece of metal coming out of a forge, or even in a oil burner. You know, certain oil burners are set up so that they got a steel plate that will get flaming red hot, and at a certain point, you don't even need the igniter anymore, because the flaming hot metal actually has an open flame on it. So when that oil vapor hits that deal, it literally ignites on demand. Got everything necessary for combustion. So you actually only have to use the igniter long enough to get the thing started, and then from that point on, it's actually using the temperature of that metal to create the combustion. And some people don't even use an igniter. They just use a torch to get the fuel started, the fuel burning. Will then in turn transfer that heat energy to the metals around it, and once those metals get flaming red hot, then from that point on, you don't even need the torch anymore. So we know how to literally use all the temperature differences to do all kinds of things, everything from cooling to heating to combustion. We know about pressure differences. We know how nature will try to balance out temperature differences or pressure differences. Nature wants to balance everything out, regardless. That's it. When you have a battery that is fully charged, you have a battery that, according to nature, is off balance. One plate has a higher number of electrons on it, or more pressure. And in order to balance itself out, there has to be a path. So now we know that if the heat wants to go to the cold side, and we want to not allow it to go to the cold side, we don't allow it no path until we choose to use allow a path. So if this temperature difference on one side of this diagram that I was talking about earlier, the Peltier element, doggone it, where's it at? Skype was in the way. Sorry about that. Peltier element energy transfer system. What you're looking at there is a battery, a storage unit, the equivalence of a balloon. You pressurized it. One side has a different pressure than the other side. One side has a different temperature than the other side. Nonetheless, it's off balance and it is stored energy for future use. There are so many implications of what this could actually be used for that it's mind-blowing. I mean, everything from automotive to heating and cooling, electrical generation, whatever. Instead of actually having to turn turbines to produce power, you could use a system such as that to take one form of energy, change it into another form of energy, store that heat energy or cold energy or pressure, Steven said, there is another byproduct from a compost pile that I haven't seen anyone utilize yet, methane gas. Well, there you go. In the process of composting, you're actually releasing methane. That's brilliant, Steven. Thank you. So you just actually got a secondary fuel source that you could ensure that that temperature difference keeps going. So while you're producing that methane, you're storing that methane into another container that you could either pressurize, store for later, or you could you pressurize it, store it for overnight, and then overnight you utilize that to keep the... That don't even make no sense, because it's still going to, the compost is still going to be rotten even in the dark. But yeah, nonetheless, we'll go ahead and use that energy anyway. We'll use it for cooking, or we'll use that energy to add yet even more heat to the system, make an even higher temperature difference between both sides, and actually maybe even producing more electricity in the process. Whew, that didn't take me a breath, man. But looking at this simple device, there's a thought experiment going on here. How far could you actually take this? Knowing that, surface area, Tesla always talked about surface area, how different pressures and different frequencies and such like that. You can generate heat using high voltage. Steven posted in there a deal from Ludic Science, which showed a voltage doubler in one of them, and high voltage dialed in another. But we actually know how to guide electricity into whatever area we want. We can actually use resistors to slow down that current flow. In the process, the resistors will generate heat because of the resistance that is going on. So even in a process of slowing down the energy that we want to be, slowing down the energy as it wants to go to the opposite side and balance the system out, which in easy terms would be, once the system's balanced out, the battery's dead. So in that process of slowing it down, that's why you'll find that incandescent light bulbs with a tungsten element inside there get heat, because the energy is trying to travel through the other side, but it's meeting resistance, which is causing friction, which in turn is causing heat in the molecules, and you get visible light. So that process of just using the energy generates heat, because of the resistance factor in transistors, resistors, diodes, every bit of electronics, anything that has any kind of form of resistance, anything that slows the energy down will produce heat. So while we're running these computers right now to do what it is we're doing, they're generating a lot of heat from the resistance. Nature's trying to balance everything back out, but we keep adding energy in from the power grid and keep forcing that energy through the materials, and at some point, if they get too hot, they fail. So we put a fan on the back of them to take the air from the outside of the computer and blow it across the heat sinks inside the computer that are connected through thermal grease to the processors, the transistors, resistors, diodes, and so on. So the whole game of everything that we've been doing in energy has to do with hot and cold. It has to do with heat temperature, has to do with pressure, has to do with moving energy from one form to the next. We generate a lot of heat by accident. In the process, as a heat is a byproduct of us trying to use electricity in the manner that we use it. So in the process of running anything, even an internal combustion engine, we're generating friction, which in turn is generating heat. And through the entire deal, heat is the bad thing. You don't want the heat. heat destroys stuff. When things reach the thermal breakdown, they begin to get soft and the parts begin to fail, and that's that. But once you got that concept in your mind, and you know that now you have this extra abundant energy that you got to get rid of just because you were trying to run something, now let's guide that energy to where we want it to go. And we get that energy to go where we want it to go to the extent that now we can take that heat away as fast as we want to heat up our house. You know, while I'm in here in this room where I do my computers, I got three computers and three monitors that are actually on, plus a light source, and I don't have a heater going. You know, in the wintertime, this it gets warm enough in here just with the energy that I'm wasting via heat that isn't naturally or necessarily being wasted to me, because it's actually keeping me warm. And during the summertime, it's even worse, because I turn the AC off so that the AC sound of the AC or air blowing and the compressor and all that kicking on and off ain't transferring in through the radio deal. So between the heat from the monitors and the heat from all the electrical devices around me, it stays pretty warm in here. And at some point, if it gets too hot, I'd have to turn the AC on, and you just have to hear a rocket engine in the background. That would be terrible. But either way, there's a lot of energy being wasted. Our electrical system, the way that we use them, are so energy inefficient that it's insane. So now that we know that, now that we know that there's a process called the Seebeck effect, it's just one of many options. You know, the drinking bird that Raymond kept on talking about works on a temperature difference. The liquid in one side gets hot, vaporizes, goes over to the other side that's already dipped into some water. Cool on that side causes that basically to liquefy again, which causes the liquid to go back over, fill up the other side, producing weight that causes it to lift back up out of the water again. Pretty cool stuff. And so that's all we're doing right there. We're just using a temperature difference. We know about the temperature difference, we know about the pressure differences, we know about different materials that will interact with each other, and essentially somebody figured it out, they designed the Peltier element. The thermal couple, the thermal pile, all work on a temperature difference. And here we go again. Once again, there are people that say, oh, you know, thermal electrics is inefficient. There are people out there who literally go out and hire crews to drill holes down into hot spots in the earth and use the temperature difference from down there to the temperature difference outside to circulate that water to produce thermal energy. The thermal energy could be used to circulate the cool water from your house down into the pipes, which goes into the heat portion of it and cause that heat transfer to go one way or the other. So you could either cool your house with heat, or you could heat your house with heat. Vice versa. The whole the whole crazy secret of free energy, it's just so ridiculously simple. It's mind-blowing. So, for people out there who want to test this particular theory, I drew this diagram. Really super simple diagram. Peltier element energy transfer system. And if you want to try the experiment, you see how well you can get this experiment to work by trying different insulation factors on both hot and cold side, by trying to make sure that both heat sinks are completely separated with the exception of each side of the Peltier element, such as in between them a possible resistive insulation that wouldn't allow one of the heat sinks to actually, you know, transfer either hot or cold from either side. The whole idea is to keep one side hot, keep one side cold at all times, and for as long as possible. And to see how long you could actually store this energy and how much energy you would get on the output side. If you blow up a balloon, you pressurize that balloon, as long as you don't release that pressure, you will have just as much pressure in that balloon as you put in that balloon for as long as it takes to open up the end of that balloon and allow that pressure to release. So with that same concept, you should be able to literally store heat and cold for extremely long periods of time and under right circumstances indefinitely. Using this little basic concept right here and trying to see how far that you could actually take it, visualizing maybe the hot side being underneath a compost heap or the hot side being on the roof of your house and the cold side being in a spring-fed pond or a well or in the shade, anywhere where there's a constant temperature difference. Now, anybody's ever been on a roof, laying down roofing material, whatever, they know that when that sun is beating down on that, those composite shingles or even concrete or any type of roofing material, metals, that radiant energy will trap itself inside the material of that roof, and it's just blazing hot on top of a roof. Some people figured this out, and they made solar water heaters. So instead of your element inside your water heater kicking on and off all the time using electricity from the grid, all it does is heats the water up on the roof and allows two processes to take place. One is gravity and the other is a thermal siphon from the temperature difference, because until the water in the tank reaches the same temperature as the water on the roof, then there will be the equivalence of the Seebeck effect going on, with the exception that it's using water and temperature as opposed to an electrical current, which it's one and the same is what I'm trying to say here. If it's always hot on your roof and it's always cool under your house, now you have a constant temperature difference. Until those two balance themselves out, until you transfer that heat energy from the roof of your house to the underneath of your house, then that effect will continue to work. So imagine if in the basement of your house you had a storage... Stephen said, you just give me an idea, Shaziz. You say you have three PCs. How about connecting ducting to the extraction fans of the base unit? Have all three blow into a hot box and below the cold box, drawing in cold air through vent holes in the cool box and in the middle of the Peltier elements. See, that's brilliant, Stephen. And here's another thing about basic science that we know. If heat rises and cold air falls, and so if you had a vent coming up underneath your house, and it's coming from underneath your house where you know it's cooler under there because you're not heating it or anything, that heat would the heat inside there would rise. As the heat was rising, it would create a suction which would bring the cool up from the bottom and circulate it through the back of your computer. And so you could actually, somebody ought to take advantage of that. Somebody ought to take and make a super cooled computer that you can use during the winter time that would take the heat off of your computer, transfer it outside, just right out to the atmosphere, and allow the atmosphere outside to be sucked in as that flow of heat is being exchanged from outside to inside, and it'll keep your doggone cooler, your computer cool, without having to utilize the doggone fan. So you'd have a thermostat on your fan that when as long as that processor stayed cold, your fan would never kick on, thus for saving you electricity. So you could actually make your computer more efficient with a simple system, basic science using heat rising and cold air falling. There's so many different potentials of it. Take the heat off of your computer, pipe it off into the next room with the door closed, and measure the temperature difference in that room as opposed to the temperature difference in this room. And all you're doing is actually using that process that is going on, because the cold air in the other room and the heat are going to interact with each other. And until that process, until that room is balanced out to the same temperature, it will continue the same process over and over. The effect will continue until those two temperature differences are equal. That's what nature does. So we've showed you could do a thermal siphon for water. You could actually, the temperature difference of one water will want to create a siphon. Heat rising will create a suction. And so you can literally use the heat rising from your furnace to suck the cool air off of the floor and circulate it up there. Those two temperature differences are going to continuously want to balance themselves out. And until that happens, all the cold air is going to fall to the bottom, all the heat's going to rise to the top. I think they call that convection. Oh, it's so ridiculously simple, it drives me insane. But nonetheless, you wouldn't even necessarily need a fan just using those two processes right there. So using basic science and physics and such, we're able to get things done using the energy forces that are around us. And if your computer is already going to produce heat because you're using it anyway, why let that heat go to waste? Why not utilize that heat for another purpose? And depending on the temperature, heat can transfer over to a liquid, which at sea level, water will boil at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. And if you're able to exceed that, then you get that water to boil and pressurize. And now you took that energy from heat energy into pressure energy, and you can turn that pressure energy back into another form of energy and actually get work done with it. People always try to argue with me all the doggone time and say there ain't no such thing as free energy. You know what? If you can't find free energy, you simply didn't pay attention in science class. You didn't pay attention in school, and you're not looking hard enough. The sun's beating down most of the day or all the day, depending on how the weather is. And even when it's cold outside and it's warm inside your house, you got a temperature difference going on. And if you could find natural ways to maintain a constant temperature difference, you can actually store heat during the nighttime or during the daytime and utilize that heat during the nighttime. That's what this diagram shows right here. Is essentially a battery. A heat battery. Peltier Element Energy Transfer System. Stephen says, I see in our pond, which is, I see a turtle in a, I see a turtle in our pond. She says, good morning, Miss Turtle. How are you today? Cool. Sorry, I had one eye looking at the screen, and I had the other eye looking at this diagram over here. I was kind of cross-eyed there for a second. And so, anyway, if you understand how energy travels, and you understand how to store energy, and you understand the differences in materials and the R factor of insulation, the resistance factor of insulation, R factor, I gotta keep on remembering that. Anyway, once you understand all these basic concepts, then you ain't got no excuse to say why it is that you don't have free energy. See, right now, the average household is wasting so much electricity, it's mind-blowing. It's not just the current flowing through there that the man down at the power company's got a big Cheshire Cat grin on his face because, you know, the more you use your appliances in the fashion that they were designed and the way that you use them, the more money he makes. And once you understand that you're basically using an energy hog system, but you got all the access to all this knowledge right here on how hot and cold work and how pressure works and how different materials will produce different types of electrical currents, you can take this energy and you can transfer it just into almost an infinite amount of different forms and just find creative ways. Alright. Somebody trying to call in. How's it going, Justin? We're live.
Great, yourself?
Pretty good. We're live on air.
Oh, yeah. I would have figured that.
Talking about energy temperature difference, hot and cold, man. Free energy.
Hot and cold.
Yeah.
Expansion and contraction.
Yep. See, we got it all figured out about how heat travels and the like you just mentioned, expansion and contraction. We know that when you heat something up, it expands. When you cool it down, it contracts. We know that heat rises and cold falls, and we know that as long as we can maintain a temperature difference in two dissimilar metals, that we can actually produce an electrical current through two different materials.
Thermolicity.
Huh?
Thermolicity.
Yeah, thermoelectricity. You said thermoelicity.
Yes, that's the correct way of saying it, yes.
Oh. Alright, so basically, as far as I'm concerned, if there was ever a proof for free energy, that right there is it in a nutshell. Because all you have to know is two different portions of nature that always maintain a temperature difference. See, once nature balances itself back out, like with a thermocouple, thermopile, or even a Peltier element, for example, once both sides of that particular material become equal, once they are both at the same temperature, then what they call the Seebeck effect stops. The thermal siphon stops. So you can take a container of water, and you can heat that water, and that water will circulate itself until all the water in that container becomes the same temperature as the heat source that you got heating it up, like a candle, for example. If you take a candle and you got like a coil of copper tubing, and the copper tubing is connected to a tank with an inlet and an outlet, then when you heat that water, you can actually see this happen too, because if you leave the top, the inlet, just hair above the water, when you heat that copper tubing, that heat will transfer through the copper tubing and begin to raise the temperature of the water that is inside the copper tubing. Well, from that point on, the hotter that water gets, the more it will pressurize, and it will literally go up the tube and in back into the same container that you're drawing it from. And until that temperature in that container actually reaches the temperature of the input of the heat source, then that process will not stop. So you can circulate water without any kind of electrical pump. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You don't need an electrical pump to circulate water that's heated, but we use an electrical pump to circulate it faster so that it's more efficient or whatever, right?
Well, yeah, but...
A radiator doesn't need a pump. It pumps itself once it gets hot. But to keep the motor cool, you want to pump it faster. You want to put it into an outside reservoir so that it has time to cool down before it comes back in.
Yeah, one of the things that would factor in to how fast you can actually get that and whether you would even need a pump. See, a pump is going to circulate it quicker so that more of that energy can actually exchange from whatever cooling source you got. Now, if you got a large, super large surface area, such as like, if you look at the size of a processor in a computer, it has a bunch of cooling fins on the top of it with a metal heat sink on there that will take all that air from the outside and give that energy a place to flow, that heat energy out that way. But if you had a larger surface area that could match the surface area of the spot getting hot, you know, spread it out is what I'm saying.
Right.
And you don't even need a pump for it because it will continuously maintain a temperature difference. So,
right.
With that said, you can actually use the sunlight outside and the coolness of your basement to do multiple tasks. You could use it to dehumidify your house by using the temperature differences to cause any condensation to, you know, basically collect. You understand what I'm saying?
Yep.
That's how a doggone dehumidifier works. One side's hot, the other side's cool, and all the oxygen and hydrogen molecules in the air out there, in the form of humidity, collects.
Another form of concentration with the humidifier. You're trying to concentrate it and collect it.
Yeah.
It's another condensation.
So.
Another way of using water. But that all has to do with, like you're saying, heat and temperature.
Yeah.
If something's cold, we know that it condenses the atmosphere. It contracts it. It's an elastics, which is the opposite of a capacitor.
Well, since we have temperature differences all over the planet, and since we know there are methods by which we can actually store heat or we can store cold, whichever one. I don't know if you actually, are you in the chat room too?
No, I'm only on my phone today.
Alright, well I'm going to send a link to a picture for you. Let's see, copy. I'm going to send it into Skype for you so that you can see this as I'm talking about it. Paste. Do. All right, can you see that picture?
Gotta load it up. The phone's slow. All
right, well, let me know when you get it loaded up. So, anyway, for the folks out there listening in, it's kind of hard on radio to show a picture, but I'll try to explain it to you as best I can. What we got going on here, I got a picture of a diagram designed up that has a Peltier element that is sandwiched between two liquid heat sinks, and on each of the liquid heat sinks have a separate container, one side for cold and one side for hot. Now, when you put power on the input side, it causes the reversed effect of the Seebeck effect, which I can't remember what the terminology for that one would have been. But either way, it causes one side of the Peltier element to get hot. and it causes the other side of the Peltier element to get cold. That then in turn heats the water on one side and cools the water on the opposite side. Now, as long as you can insulate these two containers from the outside atmosphere and there's no place for the energy to be able to transfer from one side to the next and balance themselves out, you'll maintain hot on one side and you'll maintain cold on the other side. When you remove the power input on the Peltier element, and now you have that pressure or that temperature difference stored in both containers, and until you put this under a load, until you connect the positive and the negative through, let's say, a light bulb, for example, or even a voltmeter, until you connect anything to that, there's absolutely no effect going on. The moment you connect the positive and the negative to something, and that as long as there is a temperature difference, the cold and the hot side, the Seebeck effect will cause an electrical current between the materials inside the Peltier element to send electricity, as we know it, out the other side. So it's like blowing up a balloon, pressurizing it, and then releasing that pressure that's in that balloon outside. You understand that there, Justin?
Yeah.
So this is a simple concept. It's a simple thought experiment. And if you took this same experiment and tried to see how far that you could actually push this, you could take thermal electricity and even a thermal pile and even Peltier elements and all and this knowledge to literally design a perfect system that would, if it's hot inside your house and it's cold outside and you maintain that temperature difference until that material reaches the same temperature on both sides, it will always produce an electrical current. Even if it's a small, minuscule amount of electrical current that, like for example, the thermal piles, the thermal couples, they don't really put out that much electricity. And even the Peltier element's going to put out more than a thermal couple or a thermal pile under perfect circumstances. Under the same exact circumstances, a Peltier element is going to be your best go, as long as you can keep a temperature difference on both sides of them. But even without the Peltier element, if you take a piece of steel wire and a piece of copper wire that is not insulated, copper wire, you know, you want these two to be able to touch each other, basically a dead short. And you twist these two wires together and on both ends, and then on the steel wire, let's say you choose to use the steel wire, cut the steel wire in half, put that to your voltmeter, and put one side down in some ice and put one side underneath a flame, such as a birthday candle, and you'll notice that you get a temperature or electrical current flowing. And you could actually figure out at what point that the heat from the one side overcomes the cold on the other side, and both of these metals end up at both ends the same temperature. Until they become the same temperature, until they become balanced, until nature balances everything out, that effect will continue. If it's cold on one side and it's hot on one side and it never has an opportunity to balance itself out, those will always produce electricity. Now, we know we can take that electricity, we can store that electricity into capacitors. Even if it's only a trickle charge on a battery, we got circuitry these days, transistors and resistors and diodes to literally guide energy to where we want it to go, and have like a transistor, using the transistor for a switch, you know, when until the material in that transistor reaches a certain temperature or a certain voltage, the current won't flow through to the other side. But once the temperature or the voltage raises up inside that material and allows this energy a path to the opposite side, then the switch is on. You understand that? Did I lose you?
No. I acknowledge fully what's going on with the atom inside the wire.
Well, the key to all of it is heat and cold. That is the energy that we're literally using. And what you said when you very first came on here, the expansion and contraction, if the copper wire is cold, it is contracted. All the electrons are slowed down to almost a complete and utter stop. But when you start to heat that, now you get an expansion which allows these electrons to be able to move to some extent until you excite them even more. You see what I'm saying?
Right. See, in the molecular realm, if it's pretty simple. In a wire, one part is salt and the other part is water. When we add heat, the water changes its form. The carbon doesn't change its form. The water expands. And if we look up in atomic physics, the water that's expanding is considered to be the positive electron. So when you collapse the water, it contracts. One's expanding. That's the pressure, the pneumatic pressure of that wire.
Well,
it's under force, and we have to say atomic force because it's the atmosphere that lies on the wire and has an elasticity and a rigidity. Just like when you breathe in and you exhale, that's an elastic force.
Well, we know that there are materials such as copper. Copper not only transmits electricity pretty well, it transmits heat as well. It's a good conductor. So we use copper on the bottom of certain types of pans to evenly disperse that heat energy out. We use copper in all of our coils in order to if you listen to what I'm saying right here, the answer to what people have been searching for out there, once you have an understanding of hot and cold and how they work and how electricity, you know, there's something that electricity and heat have in common. Basically. You burn your finger with both. Depending on the voltage, you see what I'm saying? Depending on the resistance, when that electricity is going through like a jumping across the spark gap, it's beating those electrons up and producing friction, which in turn is producing heat. And the same thing you're doing when you're releasing any type of heat energy into water, you're boiling that water to the extent where it finally vaporizes into steam. You see what I'm saying? So,
oh yeah.
Heat and electricity and cold all go hand in hand. The resistance,
If you heat something up, it expands, right? When we have a magnet on a rotor, we don't see the expanded magnetic field when it passes and induces the coil, but it's there. The expansion's there, and it's atmospheric. The same thing. When we heat up the copper wire, we're causing a net force.
Okay, tell everybody what the terminology that they use for whenever you're spinning magnet across either a copper coil or a copper plate. The terminology that's used for the effect that's actually going on that causes you to be able to heat water by spinning a magnet across it. You got one in your church.
What was that?
When you spin a magnet, across a copper plate or a copper coil, what is that terminology that is used to explain the effect that is occurring in there?
There's two terms. One's the original, one's the older one that's accepted by our modern scholars.
All right, well, what's it called?
The original one was the full court current, and then it switched to the eddy current.
Okay,
and
so...
it's called the anilogous current. The best description that I can give anybody is when you're in a canoe and you drag your oar, that funnel that you see, the water is going down and the air is going up. It's anilogous. It's going both ways. So when you take a magnet and you cause that tornado effect, that anilogous current to be drugged, that's the same effect that's happening.
Well,
it's like blowing your smoke in the air. You see it spinning. It's the same thing.
In even simpler terms, what's going on, if you don't understand what he's trying to say, when you're pushing that paddle through the deal and it's creating a vortex, which is causing, you know, an effect. When that magnetic field is going across, the electrons or the atoms inside that copper, it's actually shaking those electrons to the extent that it's producing friction, which in turn is producing heat. The hotter it gets, the more those electrons can move around. You see what I'm saying?
Right, because like any fluid dynamics, when you have fluid and you have an object in the fluid, it can free flow. Like when you're sitting in the bathtub and you push forward, it pushes back. That's the reverberation. But it's easy for you to slide, even though that you're 160 pounds and you're in the water, you're buoyant. It's the same thing with copper, gold, brass, all of these metals. You have salt, which is carbon, and then you have water covalently bonded to that salt. So when you heat up the water, it causes it to expand in the wire, and now the salt can orient left to right, and that's called magnetostriction.
Well, either way, the magnet that in the first explanation is the equivalence of the canoe paddle that you had. The magnetic field is interacting with the atoms inside the metals, whichever types of metals, and I believe it actually works with any type of metal. It's just some metals, because of their thickness or hard, the types of materials, their numbers of electrons. You see what I'm saying? Copper is a really good conductor of heat. We know that. And the hotter it gets, the more it allows that electron flow inside there. So actually, copper is kind of more beneficial for using as a electrical railroad track, so to speak. Even when it gets hot, if you could literally liquefy the copper wire and still keep it insulated from each one of the turns, then you would literally have a superconductor. You see what I'm saying?
Right. When copper gets hot, we have, they call it a magnetic domain, which is a branch off of magnetostriction. The salt and the water, they orientate left and right, left and right. When you heat that up to a point, it's going to slow that domain down. It's not going to be able to go as fast. And we call that as latency.
Well, example of what I'm saying is inside of every... Hold on a second. Example of what I'm talking about is in every single electric stove out there. When you very first turn an electric stove on, it takes a big load to kick it on at first, because the material that's inside the ceramic that is the element of your electric stove is solid. It's cold. It's the electrons are contracted. They're compacted, so to speak. But once the process gets to start where the current is actually flowing through there and meeting resistance and causing the lesser of the two materials to get hot and literally liquefy, if you could see inside of the element inside your stove, you would see that there's actually a liquid core to it. Once that temperature gets it liquefied, then the resistance breaks down to where it's not nearly as... It's still resistive, but not nearly as resistive as it was in its cold state. What do you think, Justin? Justin?
I try not to think because it gets you into trouble.
Oh. Huh.
But, yeah, it well, like... The physics that we're talking about is it all has to do with the molecular structure of being able to apply pressure and contract that pressure.
Yeah, well,
in a pair, right? And
nature's already provided us with the solution.
Right, and there is harmonic values like copper itself. When we put like three phase, when we have three phase going into a generator, we have, what we have is we have three lines, and each line is 120 volts, it's 60 hertz. If you add up all the hertz in one line, it's 180 hertz. That's how many cycles, vibrations, that are going in there. You can run that all on one wire and put a generator on that that has an equivalent rotor stator to it and run 180 hertz.
Yep.
And it would follow the same Lenz law rule. The higher the hertz, the higher the voltage, the lower the amperage.
Yeah. Stephen Gibbons in the chat room said a computer processor has an input voltage of 1 to 2 volts with an output of around 3,500 BTU of heat an hour. Can someone tell me of a more efficient heater? And That's one of the things that I was hoping to get to with this diagram that we were looking at here. Because if you look at the doggone computers, a lot of people, because they're running a lot of processor speed and they're trying to cram a lot of energy through these transistors, MOSFETs, any of them that are used as really fast-acting switches and so on, they're trying to run a lot of power through these doggone processors and transistors and MOSFETs and such. And in the process of that, it generates a lot of heat. So you could literally use what would have normally been something you didn't want to happen. You could take and make an electric heater using nothing more than transistors. And the only purpose of those transistors would be, you know, maybe to pulse a coil. Alright? And so, right, these coils are pulsing. In the process of pulsing, the resistance that is occurring within the transistor is producing, like Stephen explained in there, processor input of voltage between 1 to 2 volts with an output of 3,500 BTUs, you could get a multi-stage transistor. All it's doing is just pulsing coils. That's it. Nothing more. Nothing spectacular. And we haven't even talked about the energy from the coils that's been the expansion and contraction of the magnetic field being going on the opposite side. But just off the backs of those transistors alone, with a proper guidance system, you can guide that heat to boil water if you wanted to. Measure all you have to know is the thermal breakdown of the transistor when the transistor finally gets too hot and fails. If you can maintain that transistor below its thermal breakdown, the transistor will never fail. It will never go bad. You see what I mean?
Right. I know what you're saying.
So, we know how to use, in the Slayer exciter circuit, you can take anywhere from 3 volts on up to 100 volts or more or whatever, using that circuit, and you can pulse that thing enough to get a high frequency, light up a doggone fluorescent bulb using the magnetic expansion and contraction of that field, you know, collapsing and expanding, whatever. It energizes the gas in the bulb. You can light the bulb up. You can even light even LEDs up using the same process. But nonetheless, at a small amount of voltage input, it don't take a lot to get those transistors to turn on and off. You see what I mean? You don't need a whole lot of input in order to do this.
Right. So when we use transistors in the Slayer Spider, or in many different things, what we're doing is we're taking the small voltage, which is more than likely in a Slayer Exciter, it's DC, right?
Yeah.
And we're accelerating the frequency, hertz, specifically. Why is it that when we accelerate hertz, right, that we see these different phenomena? Like latency. Here, I'll give you a really good example. In aircraft, we have a transformer, and it runs at 440 hertz. Whereas, we have a transformer in the house, it runs at 60 hertz. The reason is because in an airplane, there can't be any magnetic field, any saturation on that core.
And the reason why those higher frequencies don't cause that kind of problem is because the field is expanding and collapsing so rapidly that it doesn't have time to get the full effect of a, let's say, a really like a 60 hertz or a 50 hertz slower magnetic field. You see what I'm saying?
Right. But so we run high frequencies where we don't want breakout, and the FCC and the ULC will tell you that. At 440 hertz, there's no magnetic core loss.
Yeah. The
like you're saying, you keep saying there's no worry, no reason to worry about voltage and amperage. What's really behind the veil, the garment, the mask? Tesla himself has put a quote out there. If you want to know the secrets of the universe, think in terms of frequency and vibration. Frequency is how many cycles, and vibration is the force.
Well, hot and cold is a simple explanation, because hot expands and cold contracts. And so if you can expand something rapidly enough and contract it rapidly enough, you can produce a frequency range at which this will literally tear itself apart. You see what I'm saying? And
so
that
it has nothing to do with voltage.
No, it's how fast or how slow that you're actually, you know, expanding and contracting these water molecules or any type of material. You know, that's you can take a piece of metal. And instead of having to cut it with some shears or something like that, you can use that expansion and contraction by wiggling this piece of metal back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You'll produce enough friction, which will produce enough heat that will cause that material to reach its thermal breakdown, and it will become weakened in that center, and then it will finally break in half.
Oh, I love vibratory physics.
Yeah.
That's my main area. I love it. It's the same thing. Ultrasonic drilling or anything, you can take a transformer and vibrate it and put a lead on it, and now you can cut into the rocks, just like the Egyptians did.
Well, the simple thing of this whole entire process, and the reason why I'm bringing all this up, is that if you understand how this energy travels, you can generate heat so incredibly easy. It's ridiculous. You can generate cold so incredibly easy. It's ridiculous. The biggest part of every bit of the electric bill in every single household out there has to do with hot and cold. And that's because the way that we try to generate the hot and cold is that we use mechanical force to pressurize the liquid and then go through an expansion contraction deal that would take it, just transfer this energy, hot to cold, in either direction. A heat pump system is literally working in reverse of, you know, a refrigerator. Same thing. It's all taking hot and cold from one extreme to the next. And we can store all this energy. So if it's hotter than heck outside and it's colder than heck inside, until nature actually is able to balance out those two places, you see what I mean? You're always going to have a temperature difference. Using the knowledge that we've got as far as hot and cold, we can understand electricity, we can understand pressure. You know, water is the most stable molecule on the planet. If you freeze the water molecule, it slows down. It becomes solid. If you run a high frequency through that water molecule, you literally vibrate it, and at certain frequencies, you can literally separate the water molecule completely from, you know, from water as a liquid to, you know, let's start off from water as a solid, such as ice, to a liquid, to a gas, to a two separate molecules, one being oxygen and one being hydrogen, both of which, with any ignition source, becomes a fuel. You see what I'm saying?
Well, to a lot of people, water is really mysterious.
Well, see, we don't have to... water even, there's even research out there that says water even has memory, but I don't want to go to that part yet.
Well, yes, it does, sure does. Everything is a crystalline structure. Everything is like a chain link fence held together, and it has what we call cohesion, right? The stickiness. Cohere. Right. And it's water. Like you're saying, water, you cause a rarefaction compression rate, which is sound waves in water, and that lattice, like a chain link fence, isn't perfect. It has voids in it, and those are the gaseous voids that can be pulled on and let go and slap and cause cavitation, implosion, and then it's a vampiric state.
Well, water can be utilized for hydraulic forces. It can be utilized, vaporized into pressure. It can, there's so many different uses for liquid. You can change it into a gas, or you can use it to, like, erode rocks or metal or any. It's mind-blowing when you understand the power potential that's in water alone. Now, when you combine water and heat and pressure, and you know that you can literally store all of these energies I just mentioned. You know, the solar water heater that we mentioned earlier, basically some tubing with some black material over there to absorb heat, and the sun beating down on that causes the water to either create a thermal siphon and circulate itself, or electric pump kicks on and brings the hot water into until those two temperature differences meet a balance, and that process will continue. But nonetheless, outside, when the sun is beating down on that, you can literally get that water utilizing basic physics and science to boil, you know, into steam, turned into pressure, turned into turbines. It is not beyond the realms. They got a salt water reactor, liquid salt reactor. Have you seen any things on that?
We're going backwards, is this?
No, I'm just trying to talk about...
Literally, listen. We're going backwards.
I'm just trying to talk about there are so many different methods for heat transfer.
I acknowledge that. But how come we're going backwards? And what I mean by that is, you're just talking about steam and all these things, and, you know, over the years, I've known you for probably 4 years now, you know, you're the classic guy. You talk about everything that's in our air. Okay, so put a time frame on our air. I would say 1600. The first engine, car, vehicle was made in the 1600s. It was a steam engine, and it went 4 kilometers an hour, whatever, really slow. And from the 1600s, we developed all the way to 2017. And yet, in the 1800s, our forefathers had all these devices, and they were living free off of the land. How come we're trying to live free off of the land when they were doing it? I don't, like, why are we going backwards? Like, what year did they go to the moon in?
Look, we're caught up in...
We haven't done anything since.
Listen, we're caught up in a system right now where basically people have become reliant on an electrical power grid or gas companies or whatever to get energy to live in a certain comfort level that they've been accustomed to. And most people don't understand electricity enough to do anything. Most people don't understand mechanical energy enough to do anything. In order to break free from that prison of being under the thumb of the power companies or the utilities or any of the fuel industries whatsoever, you have to go back to being able to teach people about basic science, basic physics, that they can understand that there is a much simpler way, and that indeed, if they understand these, they could utilize all this information to get the same things that they got now, but not have to pay people to do it. You know, the Amish communities, they got refrigerating processes that they use that go back for hundreds of years. And they're able to keep their food cool during the summertime when it's hotter than heck outside. They still have ice inside these refrigerators. And that's one process that over time got lost to the average Joe. But
I grew up in this era, right? I'm 33. I'm a millennial, right? And I've grown up with all of these things around me.
Yeah, but listen, Justin.
What separates me from the incompetence?
Sure, listen. For the average Joe out there, you go up and ask just the average Joe, how do the Amish keep their food cool during the summertime? And they will, some of them will get it, most of them won't, some of them will have ideas about it, but they don't understand the full process of how they are actually doing it. You know, if they understand anything about insulation, they might figure it out that, you know, like if you get a cube of ice and you got a R factor of ridiculous proportions, which is when Stephen reminded me earlier in there that the R factor is the resistance to temperature change. Basically, if you had a super thick R factor, you know, like that foam insulation they use in construction that will keep a barrier between the cool or the hot that you want to keep at a certain temperature, it will remain at that temperature until there is a path for that energy to transfer somewhere. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
If it's hot, it'll stay hot. If it's cold, it'll stay cold. So you're in a perfect insulated system, you could keep an ice cube forever because there wouldn't be no place for that energy to transfer to. You see what I mean?
Right. I know it's really insane, but I think it's kind of funny that
something's wrong with your microphone. I can't hear you very good.
No?
There you go. Now I hear you.
Alright, that's weird. I just turned the phone around. But I think it's absolutely funny that we as a species, we go to a petting zoo and we pet animals. We're saying for the average Joe, they can't acknowledge these things, comprehend, grasp these things, that, you know, that every bird and every deer and turtle in the world has no problem with the way of life, except for something that's, you know, a human that, you know, we say that we're not primitive, but I think it's totally the opposite, man. Apes don't go around shooting each other and fighting over freaking land.
Well, that's why we're doing what we're doing here, man. Trying to get people to the understanding. Same reason why Tesla tried to give everybody free energy, because he knew that if there wasn't no reason to be fighting over resources, then everybody would have what they needed, and that's that. You wouldn't have the wars and stuff. So, the whole concept of free energy, the whole concept of free energy, for whatever you think about it, or all the different arguments against it, or any of that, the whole concept of free energy is so that you can free people from the bondage of having to pay the power company all the time. Plus, you give them something that people don't have to fight over anymore. Why go to a war over oil when it's not necessary? Because there's so many different fuel sources that are better than oil, and we're not utilizing them as a society because our system is already set up in place to make other people money. Patty Walking Turtle in the chat room said, people have become comfortable. Flip the switch to turn the knob. It's much easier to have someone else provide the energy. Most people today have jobs and much more activity on a daily basis. They do not grow their food. Working 40 hours a week and raising children make it difficult to produce energy and food. And she's couldn't be more right. And that's the whole thing. You know, the average Joe is so reliant on the system that if the system ever failed, such as the power grid went completely down, they wouldn't know what to do. They wouldn't know how to cook things, you know, without no electricity. And if they flipped the switch and the light didn't come on, if they didn't have a flashlight with another switch and an already power source, then they wouldn't know what to do. The Mad Science Show is here to try to teach them what to do. To try to show them that there's so many possibilities out there. Folks, I want you to do a simple experiment. A real simple experiment. Try it for yourself. And, of course, you're going to get the naysayers out there that's going to argue with you or tell you, well, you know, you had to put too much energy in this side, and then you had to put too much energy in that side. It's inefficient, and it's not free energy. But I want you to understand the concept of something so basic as a thermocouple, a thermopile, or Peltier element. You do this experiment, and you put ice on one side, and you put a heat source on the other side, you're going to generate electricity. All right? Now, if your system is super inefficient at that point, well, you just, the experiment that you did, but you use the thought process that you've now utilized in order to even do the experiment, and you see how far that you can actually take this. A Peltier element. One Peltier element by itself, you know, how many volts can you get out of it? Using this diagram that I showed on there, you know, the energy input is more than I'm getting out of it. Alright? You're only looking at it in a one-dimensional sense. I'm asking you to take this diagram and look at it in a four-dimensional or even further sense. If you are able to store heat energy in one side and cold air energy in on the other side, you just made a battery. You just stored that pressure, that heat, and the temperature difference in two separate containers for later use. Now, if you can keep that temperature difference going on for a long time, until it's able to balance itself back out and both sides are the same temperature, that effect will keep on going. Now, this is just one unit by itself. Imagine multiple units in row with each other, set up on a timer that would literally take energy from the sun, transfer it into hot and cold energy into this system, and then that hot and cold energy, because you have so many of them, is the equivalence of adding a battery to your solar panel. For every battery you got, you have so many amp hours per battery that you can use that energy when you're running an inverter. The larger your bank, the longer the time that you can actually run this. I proved this concept in a video called Unsubscribe, and I believe a video that I called 9 Volt, where essentially I took some capacitors, and using a small input, I was able to, once I got that thing up to its full pressure, I could let off of the generator and allow that energy to flow back downhill, so to speak. It flowed from the Olympic-sized swimming pool to the smaller swimming pool to the smaller swimming pool down to the bucket, down to finally the glass, and so on. But the key factor in that whole process was that as long as that Olympic-sized swimming pool had energy coming in from any direction, it didn't even have to be a lot of energy. As long as it would never allow that Olympic-sized swimming pool to get empty, then all the systems below that would remain functional. They would have enough pressure, they would have enough electricity to run the entire system. I ran 10 separate 9-volt circuits off of one system, just because I pressurized the top and allow that energy to do what it naturally does. Nature's trying to balance itself back out, so it's going to pull that energy off and go downhill to the smallest load there. And eventually, the last thing that's going on is that you got a piezoelectric speaker and a little blinking LED. And so, when the blinking LED can no longer has enough energy for it to blink anymore, the piezoelectric crystal will still sit there and beep for a long period of time, because the piezoelectric speaker itself is the smallest of all the energy draining loads, if you understand what I'm trying to say. So utilizing utilizing this knowledge right here, the temperature difference between heat and cold, and welcome, Muddy. Glad to see you here, brother.
Yeah, good morning.
All we're doing is guiding energy where we want it to go. And utilizing this little diagram right here and the knowledge that we've got from hot and cold and how they react, the effects, expansion from things heating up to contraction to things getting cold, to pressurization, temperature differences, different types of materials that will allow the materials to try to exchange electrons at certain temperature ranges, and as long as there's a temperature difference and they can never balance themselves out, that's why the Peltier element is able to be used in reverse. You heat one side, you keep the other side cold, it produces a Seebeck effect, which produces electricity and pushes that energy out somewhere. And you can take that energy off of that, store it into a capacitor, store it into a battery, and so on down the line. So, in itself, that one single Peltier element is not going to run your house. But utilizing the knowledge that you've now acquired from that, you can take every bit of waste energy in your house, including your PCs, your TV monitors, your electrical appliances, anything with a transformer, knowing if you reach down there and touch it, or if you got something to measure the temperature on there, if there is a temperature coming off of that in the form of waste heat, then there is a temperature difference in the atmosphere, and so that even the doggone what you call wall works, Muddy, those have an effect in your room as far as how warm your room is. If your room is sealed up and insulated real well, it would take longer to heat your house with a wall wart, but nonetheless, that energy, as long as that energy kept going into that, there would be a temperature transfer, or an energy transfer into that room, which eventually, until it balanced it out, would continue to come in. As long as there was no way that the cold from the outside could leak into the inside of that room, just like I proved in my redneck hot tub video, that I could take a coffee pot element and I could heat water up to such an extreme that you can't physically sit in it. It would kill you, literally. It'd be too hot. You see what I'm saying? Took a long time to get it up to operating temperature, but once I got it there, at some point, had to shut the element off because the water got too doggone hot. And it wasn't insulated underneath, and it was not insulated over the top, so it was exposed to the atmosphere and on all sides. You see what I mean? Did we lose Justin? Did we lose
you? Yes, we did. I'm going in and out myself.
Oh, that stinks. All right, so what do you think?
I think if you had a room that was had a vacuum between the two layers, maybe some glass standoffs so you can keep a vacuum in it.
Well,
that could be pretty thermal. I mean, I put ice in this. It looks like a picture.
Yeah.
You know, for putting Kool-Aid or whatever in a pitcher. And, doggone, man. I put ice. I filled that sucker up with ice, and then I put the Mountain Dew. I did it at the store. 2 days later, I still had ice in that sucker. And I was like, wow.
Well,
I guess because the soda from the fountain, which was Mountain Dew, was pretty cold, and the ice was cold, and it efficient than most thermoses. I mean, it is a thermos. The funny thing, you just turn the lid to the left a little bit, and then you can pour it and put it back. Every time I picked it, I had it in the back of the car. So I figured if you could do a room with two layers and basically have a vacuum between them, which would mean you'd need some stand-up, because that's a lot of pounds per square inch trying to force the pieces together. Glass stand-offs would be good, because glass doesn't conduct heat very good. So I figure if you did that, shoot, the heat of your body would heat, the, you know, keep you warm in the winter.
I challenge somebody to go out there and find the oldest ice cube in the world. What do you think? Did I lose you again? Oh, I hate it when that happens. All right, until there's some sort of outside influence for a place, a path for energy to transfer from one point to the next, you can maintain and store temperature. So, are you back?
I'm back.
Huh. So,
at least for another 2 minutes.
All right. So you're able to, let me hang up this call with Justin and call you back direct, see if that helps.
How about if I call y'all back?
All right. Just call me by myself, because I guess Justin bailed.
No, that's all right. I'll call him. He can drop out if he wants.
All right.
I mean,
whatever works.
I call you from the computer. It'll be lots better.
All right. Whatever works. Alright, sorry about that, folks. But anyway, simply put, this little diagram right here, if you want to try to expand on it, you can literally solve the so-called... What in tarnation? Alright. Okay, I'm here.
There we go.
Now, what I was saying before that phone call... If you want to solve the so-called energy crisis and you want to solve the old free energy equation, you have to understand heat, you have to understand cold, you have to understand pressure, and it's all really super simple stuff. It's all basic science.
Thermodynamics.
Thermodynamics, and I can hardly hear you. You sound like you're like a block and a half away.
Is that a little better?
That's a little better. How about now?
If it holds out, I might need to replace the battery.
Alright. Well, anyway, thermodynamics. We know how heat travels, hot to cold. We know how pressure works. Man, I'm trying to... I'm sitting here trying to tell everybody we have every single answer to every single question necessary to literally give the world free energy. It's pure ridiculousness that we don't do it.
And the government's got the funding to put it all in all in effect, except in 2 weeks, all the money that it would take in order to buy everything and pay the people to set it all up gets spent in 2 weeks for war.
Well, yeah. Look at NASA's budget alone.
And what are they fighting over? They're fighting over oil. They're fighting over energy.
Yeah.
You know what? They want you to keep doing the oil because it pollutes the earth, and they can, you know, the thing is, if they just put out the free energy, they figure a lot of other people start doing free energy, and then they ain't getting the money. That's what it's all about. It's about the money. They got the funds. They know how to do it. But we have all the answers. Yes, there's better answers, and we're learning more answers. I mean, we don't know everything, but we're learning. But we have enough. We know more than enough to supply the whole earth with enough energy, where people can keep on flipping that stupid switch and be dumb about everything and they can sit there and play their Xbox and ignore the state of the world and do all that stuff. It's fine. I mean, we have the technology and we have enough people that know what the heck they're doing that these people can keep on being blind and just hit the switch and it'll be fine. And it shouldn't cost as much, but if they thought about it, they could actually still keep the same amount of money without polluting the earth, without having to dig for oil and suck all the lifeblood out of the living planet.
Well,
and poison it.
That's why people like you and I are so dangerous to the system, and that's why they send the debunkers out to try to convince everybody things are not possible.
You know what? My biggest pet peeve is stupidity. Stupidity, to me, is the way they go about things. Because, look, if they can make the same amount of money, and everything could be on, be wired and everything like that, let's keep some oil around. We can still run generators when we got problems and things like that. And fire up the nuke plant if we got, whatever. I don't frown on having these things available. Let's put it this way. When I've got half the tools that I need, I'm handicapped. But if I got all the tools I need, man, you can work so much faster. 5 to 10 times faster, get more things done. You know what? If you don't have a doggone the right size wrench, a crescent wrench will work. Or a nut driver on an impact. You know, you can get so much done having tools. But when you're handicapped, and that's basically what they're doing, they'd rather they want to sit there and keep on poisoning the world and all this stuff. It's really stupid to sit there and suck the life energy out of the earth and then poison it rather than just using what's readily available from a nuclear power plant 92 million miles away.
Well, see, that's the whole thing is...
It only takes 8 seconds for that energy to get here.
All the processes that I'm talking about, they're not going to affect the earth. They're not going to pollute the earth. They're just going to use what nature's already doing and guide the energy where we want it to go. See, everybody keeps looking for over-unity and zero-point, which are two jokes. I mean, it's the unicorn, the Bigfoot, whatever. You know, we don't need over-unity. We don't even need zero-point. All we got to do is utilize the forces of nature that are already provided to do everything that it is that we want done. We literally allowed a system that is an energy hog. You got to burn a whole bunch of coal in order to be able to produce steam to turn generators, or you got to be able to burn fuel in a combustion chamber, diesel fuel or whatever, to turn a generator. Or you got to highly compact radioactive material in order to boil water in order to turn a generator. And even the process of the generator itself, the way that it's designed, is inefficient. There's a guy out there that I talk about all the time. His name's Sky Collection. If anybody ever accidentally stumbles on to over-unity or free energy device that can be measured and proven right out of the gate, it's going to be that guy. Because he's showing an efficiency rise. Every single piece of equipment that he makes, that he's making by itself, continuously gets better in efficiency.
He uses them wide, round, flat magnets.
He also uses...
He gets them things spinning so fast, and it's high RPM, and I'm like, man, if one of them things flies off, it's gonna be like a doggone quarter shot out of a gun.
Yeah, but nonetheless...
Frisbee, it'll cut somebody up. I said, doggone, you need some kind of shield in there, but you know... Just watching his stuff, you know, you're going, oh man, I hope that thing don't fly apart. But he's showing a lot of energy. I mean, that's the point.
Yeah, and he's showing more efficiencies. He's showing how lessening the lens effect and so on down the line. The guy's incredible. He's one I'd want on the dream team. But nonetheless, the information's out there. If you pay attention like he did, if anybody ever stumbles onto it, he's going to be the one. And I'm sitting here telling everybody it's already there. He's proven it on a daily basis. And all these other things that we keep talking about have been proving it on a daily basis.
Right.
We could make our internal combustion engine so incredibly efficient that they barely use any fuel. The forces, look how many, I want somebody out there in this world who likes to do experiments and measurements. I want you to do some math and figure out how much energy that an internal combustion engine actually wastes. Never mind how much it uses, how much does it waste?
I'll tell you how much it wastes. You get in that car and you fire it up. You go down the road. Only 5% of that energy reaches the wheels. 5%. And then they put you an alternator in there that's 5%. So if you got say you got 65 horsepower, you know, Datsun 210. Guess what? One third of it is taken up by the air conditioner. Another third is taken up by the alternator, which is only 5%, which takes 20 horsepower to get 1 horsepower worth of electricity out of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and you're existing on one third of that? 20-something horsepower? Well, I understand one horse can pull it, but, you know, at the speed that's got to go in the wind resistance.
Sunday night ride. Will someone try open up your eyes? You must be blind if you can't see the gaping hole called reality. Wanna do it again? I'm gonna do it again. Wanna do it again? Come on.
Starship Enterprise, its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Okay, and we're back. Let me take a drink of my coffee here. Buddy, you still there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. Does that sound any better?
Yeah. Okay, the question in the chat room from Patty, Walking Turtle. He says, I have a question for the panel. We are coming into a solar minimum. This will produce a possible mini ice age with a probability of lasting 20 to 50 years. During this time, the temperature of the planet will wane. The warm seasons will lessen. This will be detrimental to agricultural and energy systems. What can we do to mitigate these issues? Well, in my mind, it's as simple. It's as simple as that diagram that I just showed a minute ago. The one I talked about, if you don't know which one I'm talking about, jump over there to the superchat.html and click on the picture. It's red and blue. It says hot and cold on it. It says Peltier Element Energy Transfer System. Well, in this, I explained how we could actually store heat and cold energy and how we could actually turn that heat and cold energy into electricity. So, knowing how energy travels, knowing that you, it's cold outside, you have to be warm inside, and most plants need some warmth in order to be able to survive, and most need the photosynthesis process via the sunlight to produce energy. One thing that would be very beneficial, as long as you had access to sunlight, would be greenhouses. And if you could replicate what is going on in a greenhouse, then you could also be able to grow food all year round. Let's say, even in worst case scenario, you're like up in the deepest, darkest, iciest snow covered. It's snowing outside. You can't see the sun for nothing. So ain't no solar energy getting through all that snow and ice.
But if it's cold and you can't heat the greenhouse, everything freezes.
That's right. And so
Here's my point. Compost beds are warm. Compost beds, and even if the plant freezes, the roots stay alive because it's warm. And if you run a layer of plastic over it, you can keep the moisture that is not frozen. You can keep the moisture down in there to keep everything alive. That helps out, and that also allows sunlight to hit the soil as well.
Yeah.
The greenhouses are pretty cool. I mean, here's the deal. You look at what percentage of the earth is covered with our buildings. I'm pretty sure we can do a little agriculture with buildings, or basically being able to suspend clear material above. But the main problem there is with your polymers and petroleum products, is they'll degrade in the sun, and you'll have to be replacing them quite a bit. And when that breaks up, plastic breaks up and it gets into small deals, it'll wind up in your soil and next thing into your food. So I suggest let's use the borosilicate and get it done right. See, let's put it this way. Rich people don't put them cheap windows in that you got to replace every 4 or 5 years or 10 years, because they if they spend the money first, they wind up saving a lot more money by not having to replace them and paying people to replace them.
All right, well.
So the main deal is go ahead and spend the money. I mean, look, you got doggone skyscrapers in New York and all around, and they're glass all the way around, and it's all borosilicate. You don't need to use a bunch of land to do this. The sun shines sideways twice as long as it shines downward. And at angles, it still works. So, even though some of it's reflected, it'll reflect to the other buildings around it.
All right, well,
I say make skyscrapers, make your vertical farms. You don't have to use a bunch of land, and you don't have to use cheap plastics and garbage like that. Now, if you use a plexiglass or something like that that's not going to break, that's okay, because it's not going to deteriorate and go into the food.
That's good information.
That's my idea. And the compost and everything can be reused again, and actually keep the building warm, especially with two layers of glass, because you have an insulated barrier between, and if you put a vacuum on it, hell, it can be close to a thermos.
All right, that's good explanation, but back to the worst case possible scenario. Worst case scenario, you ain't got no sunlight because it's snowing outside 24/7. The sun's blocked out. You ain't got no kind of sunlight whatsoever for photosynthesis to occur. We have enough information about how photosynthesis works and how different light spectrums. We can literally grow plants in basements of houses. The happy grass growing individuals, they already know this. They have certain types of light bulbs that they can used to replicate sunlight and be able to grow food. Now, as far as being able to feed large amounts of animals and stuff like that, not even a problem. I did a video here just a little while ago that had to do with duckweed. And so, with that said, you got to have nutrients for duckweed to grow. Well, there's a lot of waste products that you're also going to have to get rid of. If, let's say, you're in a self-contained system and you need to be able to get rid of bio waste, not only could you use it for compost like what Muddy was explaining, but you could also use it to add nutrients to a water like a septic pond would do, so that that nutrients would feed that duckweed. You see what I'm saying? The duckweed actually has a filter, but it grabs up all the nutrients and all the good stuff out of the deal, and that right there would be feed for livestock. There's also ways to grow algae, all different types of plants. Look, folks, we know enough about nature right now that if we utilize all the basic science available to us, we could literally grow food in the cave with no sunlight and in the worst possible conditions, even if it's colder and all, get outside using everything we know about insulation. You wouldn't have to worry about things being too cold where you couldn't grow food. There are tons and tons of caves structures throughout the entire world. If worst case scenario, we all had to go down inside the caves to get away from the cold, we could still replicate what nature has done to the extent that there would not be a food shortage. The governments have got this figured out. You think they don't have bunkers that already have built-in greenhouses that are using artificial lighting systems? There's actually a conspiracy out there about somebody has a patent on an artificial sun. You know what that means? Muddy.
That means we're in danger.
If you have an artificial sun, then that means you already know how you can replicate the light spectrums necessary to grow food even in the worst possible conditions. It means you could build the equivalence of a Dyson sphere and basically wrap the entire earth around, you know, block out the sun that we got on the outside and utilize a man-made sun in order to produce the energy necessary to do everything that it is. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of an ice age. I'm not afraid of doomsday or any of that kind of stuff, because if we really seriously wanted to survive, we got all the answers necessary to replicate exactly what nature has been doing all along and be able to get through. It's as simple as that.
Ice age, do you think the wind's going to stop?
The wind's going to keep going. Matter of fact, probably get worse, because if it's warm on one side of the earth and cold on the other side, that temperature difference is going to cause, what do they call it, convection?
That's right.
So, we got enough answers right now that on the average Joe's level right now, the way your house is built up, wouldn't survive an ice age, literally. You'd have to reconstruct your house, reinforce your house, insulate it, and build in systems where you had underground gardening and such, and using what Muddy talked about of composting, you could recycle waste into heat and be able to keep it warm inside. Where there's a will, there's a way. We know how to do this. Everything, even free energy, is reliant on temperature differences and pressure and so on. So, as far as the answer to the question right there, it wouldn't be a problem whatsoever to grow enough food if you knew what nature's already done so far. We know that there's aquaponics, hydroponics, and I don't remember what they call it for actually growing doggone it, wacky tobacco in your basement with lights.
That's hydroponics.
Hydroponics. Okay.
Hydroponics, aquaponics, that's where you grow your fish too and stuff. And
okay. So either way, you know that if you can grow that kind of plant down inside the basement or off underneath the shed or in the cave somewhere or out of sight, out of mind, that same process will function to literally grow other types of fruits and vegetables and stuff like that. So maybe you ain't going to get all the best of foods, and maybe you ain't going to get all unless you had a community that was willing to come together and literally build a equivalence. Remember that movie a long time ago that they had that was like a biosphere that these people went inside of see how long they could live on a completely self-sustained environment?
Yeah, and some idiot brought a gun.
Yeah. Only took one knucklehead to make a mess out of everything.
There'll always be an idiot in the crowd.
But in a perfect world, using everything we know, modern day science and physics, mathematics and such, we could figure it all out. Get the brilliant brains from around the world. Patty said during the solar minimum there will be a lot more radiation which will make its way to Earth due to the sun's weakened magnetic tether and magnetosphere.
That would warm it up.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's the thing. Our magnetosphere, I've heard so many different things about pole shifts and a bunch of ridiculousness that don't have anything to do with real science. The Earth and the Sun, they have a relationship where they exchange energy. And even if you blocked out all the sunlight, until our Earth's core, according to the way science has explained it, until our Earth's core cools completely, we will never lose our magnetic field. And until our Earth's core begins to rotate in the opposite direction, we will never have a pole shift. Now, don't get me wrong here. There's a difference between pole shift and pole fluctuation, such as why they say that, oh, well, if the poles never shifted, why is it that cooling down lava leaves these magnetic tracer lines in the lava? Everything has a temperature where there's a sweet spot in there between hot and cold when things are cooling down, that if the sun put off a coronal mass ejection, according to how science explains it to us, and that coronal mass ejection hit our magnetosphere, it would literally stretch our magnetic field out, and as it's snapping back into place, during that time when our magnetosphere was literally stretched out, if it hit the sweet spot of that temperature as that lava is cooling down, it would literally take a snapshot in that moment in time of where the magnetic field was at during that particular point in time. What it did not show is that an instantaneous reversal back to right where it was before that that coronal mass ejection hit the Earth. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
It ain't no different than taking a electric motor and reversing the polarity on it to get it to spin in the opposite direction. When you flip two magnets over, they reverse polarity. North is on one side, south is on the opposite side. The same thing goes. But if your core is spinning one specific direction, as science says it does, and it's hot, producing the thermoelectric charge, which is actually producing the magnetic field that we have around us that they call the magnetosphere, that can never flip. As long as it's going in that same direction, as long as the temperature remains, the only thing that could happen from an outside influence was when the magnetic field of the solar flare affected our magnetic field temporarily. You see what I mean?
Yep, and as a matter of fact, the Earth would have to stop spinning to completely knock all that out.
Yeah.
See, as long as the electrons are going in a certain direction, then we'll have a magnetic field. But let's put it this way. They say if everybody in China jumped off the toilet and landed on the ground at the same time, it would knock us out of orbit. And they they totally disproved that, is because when they jumped off the toilet, theirs should have went the other direction. And then when they landed, equal and opposite reaction balanced out to zero. But we have neodymium iron boron magnets. What if everybody polarized them? You know, say you're on 37 degrees longitude, and so we put them in the, you know, we put them in the correct angle and set them up there, so we'd still have the, we'd still have a magnetic field. How many magnets do you think they can make? How much magnetism do you think you can make? As a matter of fact, if you take a 10-foot loop of wire, you say you make about 10 turns, and you put a commutator down at the bottom and you spin that thing, the Earth's magnetic field is good enough to actually make that a generator.
Yeah.
Because you're spinning that loop in a big enough area to collect that much magnetism.
Right.
There's a lot more magnetism around you than you think.
But, right.
What if we could keep the magnetic field aligned just by aligning what we have in magnets?
Yeah, I need to get another point back in there, because Patty was talking about, what about thermodynamics? This could provide warmth as well as energy, I would think. And then Stephen said, geothermal, you mean, Patty? And yes, this would be available as it relies on the Earth's magnetic field, not the sun, but it would lessen also as the interaction between the sun and the Earth is less. All right, look, here's something to contemplate. Okay, we're in a complete and utter ice age. Worst case scenario, we're in a complete and utter ice age. Unless the sun itself ceases to exist, unless it stops doing what it does, there's no way for our Earth, even though we're surrounded by snow, to completely freeze up. And here's the reason why. We have a satellite, such as the moon, that actually is locked with us. All right, and as the Earth and the Moon are spinning around each other, there's forces at play going on there that are expanding and contracting and basically friction from the tugging of each other as they're being hurtled around. This is with science explanation. We live on a globe. There's a moon that is surrounding us that causes our tidal effects and our seismic activity, and even the sun itself is affecting the moon. And so as long as the moon is spinning around us, it's going to generate friction, which in turn is going to generate heat. Our Earth's core and the crust of our Earth and all these effects going together, and the spin of the Earth itself, the rotating liquid core of the Earth itself, would have years and years and years worth of stored energy. So, unless the sun quit doing what it does, and we turn into a literal ball of ice, then we will not lose the thermal electricity of the sun. So even in the worst case scenario, even during a solar minimum to where the sun isn't putting out the amount of energy that it normally does, even in that instance, the sun is still putting off enough radiant energy and enough sunlight to keep us warm so that we don't become completely solid. Such as a planet that, for example, we're what, the third planet from the sun? The further you get out, the colder the planets get, and when you finally get out where you're so far away from the sun, like Pluto, it's a ball of ice. Alright? And even that, some people think that if that is in a geocentric orbit or whatever with the planets, that even Pluto could have a warm core to it. You see what I'm saying? From the friction rotating around and the fluctuation. You understand what I'm saying there?
That and the pressure.
Yeah. From the pressure, the friction, the heat, and all that kind of stuff. There's moons out by Jupiter, because of Jupiter's size, that they say that are potentially liquid oceans underneath the frozen ice and stuff. You see what I mean?
Yep.
But there would have to be a whole lot that would go on that would actually turn us into an ice ball in order for our thermoelectrics to stop. And even worst case scenario, future history of time, we know enough about physics that if we wanted to, we could literally keep the planet warm using all the forces that are available. You see what I mean? Now, that's sci-fi and way off into the future. If we really wanted to, we could go to other planets and generate heat using physics and basic science. What do you think?
Well, I do know if there's only so... Let's just say the magnetic pole shifted and it decided to start turning the molten core the other direction. At one point, it has to stop before it goes the other direction.
Yeah.
It's like on a, just like on a sinusoidal waveform or a sine wave, it crosses zero twice per cycle. So, I mean, but then... if you have stored energy and you start using it, it depletes as well.
Yep. Well, either way, the sun's out in the space. They say the sun is 93 million miles away from the Earth, and so even though most of us got like a big old snow-covered deal, the whole entire Earth will never be completely iced in unless the sun stops doing what the sun does.
Well, that's a wonderful thing, too. See, water... We have water.
Yeah.
Water is the savior of so many things. You're up in Alaska, it's 60 below, and the wind is howling and blowing. Well, they survived by making an igloo a house out of ice, because inside it's not going to drop any more than 32 degrees. Yep. Because that's the temperature of the ice. Plus you have your body heat, which you're not venting out very much because you're pretty well bundled up to keep your heat in. But you can survive. The thing is, I guess what Patty's getting at is how are we going to keep our plants alive?
Well, that's where the science comes in as far as hydroponics and aquaponics and, you know, heat and cold. We know how to transfer those two. We know how to take those two temperature differences. If it's warm inside your igloo, the candle difference between the temperature outside, you could heat that element up on one side, and the cold from the outside is hitting the other side, and it will continuously produce electricity that you could then in turn use that electricity to store and be able to run lighting systems that would mimic the light spectrums of the sun. In my mind, it's so ridiculously simple, but if governments knew that there was a coming ice age and they didn't tell nobody, it would be an intentional deal. You know, well, we can't fit this many people in our bunker, and we don't have enough room, and we don't have enough food, and so we're unfortunately going, they're going to have to be collateral, you know. We the average...
I learned this by reading on Weather Underground some of the articles and stuff on the off pages, not just your main forecast pages that everybody looks at. That snow, there's different densities. Like sleet, you get an inch of sleet, you've got pretty much about more than 3/4 inch of actual water. But in some of the instances, and then the snow starts getting fluffier and fluffier and fluffier. There's snow fluffy enough where 18 inches of snow is less than an inch of water.
Yeah.
So, as you can pack things up, if you can melt some of it, you can turn it into ice and you can get it clear. And, you know, I'm saying, look, you see no Superman's place right there, all crystal?
Yeah.
Now, that'd be pretty cool.
Well, we know enough about thermodynamics, hot and cold, pressure, and temperature differences, that in worst case scenario, things started getting really cold really fast, and the average Joe wanted to survive, where there's a will, there's a way, come together as communities and take all this science and utilize it to survive impending doom?
Let's just say the inside started melting because it's warmer than 32 degrees. And if you pumped it up to the top where there's new fresh snow, you could turn that into ice and just keep building it. It'll get bigger and bigger.
Well, Eskimos, before electricity, were living in igloos made out of ice. Alright, and so they survived, and they was able to keep enough food and be able to utilize all the resources around them to survive long winters and that kind of stuff. So if they can
actually, they never lived in igloos. That's only emergency shelter.
But, well, nonetheless, they were able to survive in them.
But they did build very thick houses.
Well, then they learned about R factor. Insulation. And so, everything necessary to survive and everything to find free energy has been there on the table all along. Plain and simple. Forces of nature. When I share these diagrams with people, these pictures, these ideas right here, and I call it a thought experiment, that's because I want people to look at this and see what's going on and think about how far you could actually take it. Knowing that you can store heat and cold, knowing that you can store pressure, knowing that you can store energy of all different types. That energy can be utilized to get work done, and heating and cooling. That energy could be utilized to run lighting systems for growing plants. If science is correct, and we're ever to boldly go where no man's gone before, at some time in the...
Well, don't go there.
Huh?
I said, don't go there.
At some time in the near future, if we ever have to leave this rock, and we wasted all this time arguing over what we know and what we don't know, we ain't gonna make it. Right now, we got every single answer to every single question that if we seriously want to literally travel through space, we could build a spaceship that would sustain humans all the way through the entire journey. Our Earth is our spaceship right now. It's a self-contained biosphere of epic proportions, has more energy necessary to get all the work done that we need. We just need to learn how to use it more efficiently, more respectfully, properly, whatever words that you can think about that resemble the same concept. If you're burning firewood,
2 points I gotta make.
You get heat off the firewood. You get
two points I gotta make here.
Okay, hold your point for a second. If you burn firewood, you get heat off of that firewood. A lot of the heat goes up the chimney, gets wasted. We could use that heat. If you, while you're burning the heat, you're producing a waste product, which is ash. And creosote. Creosote sticking to the sides of the chimney and ash sticking to the bottom of the burner. Both of which are things that can be utilized to make other things. All we did was turn that log into more energy and more resources. That waste product becomes fertilizers, becomes soap, becomes fuel. It's a simple example. Now, where's your 2 points?
Okay. 1 point on space and the other one on agriculture. And that goes right along with what Patty was talking about. We'll start with space. Building a ship that we could all escape from. Here's the deal. In order, there's radiation frequencies out there that must be absorbed by nothing more than lead. To get that much lead up into space to hold a population, more energy than we got.
Well,
matter of fact, if we actually did go to the moon, and made it back. We're very, very lucky that the astronauts did not get radiation sickness and radiation poisoning.
Sure, but minus... listen.
Okay, and then I'll get to my other point.
Minus the whole radiation factor and all that, and whether we did or didn't go to the moon, because I couldn't care less, but the physics are there that if we wanted to, we have the capability right now. We make microwaves inside of an oven that will boil water, all right? And we know that all we got to do in order to take that microwave and make it safe for anyone standing outside the microwave looking in is to put a Faraday cage in between there. So all we did was break up that radiation, all right, that microwave. We just broke it up. The same thing could be done with multiple radio frequencies. You can ride a frequency on top of a frequency on top of a frequency on top of a frequency to infinity, both forward and back.
It comes back down to a lot of energy.
Yeah, sure. But nonetheless, you can actually use the incoming energy of the sun to produce the outgoing energy of the magnetic field that would mimic our magnetosphere and keep the doggone radiation from ever even entering the craft.
And there's plenty of radiation from the sun.
Yeah.
Plus the radiation that you need to shield yourself from or you get radiated. That is a nuclear power plant.
You ever heard the saying, fight fire with fire?
Right.
Well, if it's radiating you and you're absorbing that radiation and you need to deflect that radiation, you use what we've learned from magnetic fields. Anytime two magnetic fields interact with each other, they respond accordingly. Yeah, they will try to combine and become one field. Well, if you're sending out a radioactive wave, not radioactive, that's the wrong terminology, especially in today's day and age, but if you're sending out a wave, you can literally deflect the weaker wave. You see what I'm saying?
Yep. Well, you can make glass with different kinds of things that filter out different wavelengths of light, but radiation itself is kind of... you know, the radiation that where you get radiation sickness and radiation poisoning, that's a little harder to do. They haven't made a clear lead yet.
Well, here's the thing. Your concept was about absorbing this energy. We don't want to absorb it. We want to send it away. Because as you absorb it, it's actually going to generate heat. And that's going to be just as bad as the radiation. So we don't want to absorb it. We want to deflect it.
And we can recreate sunlight with lamps and everything and use solar panels to collect that energy.
Yeah.
Plus, we can also, I've got a solar panel, as they call it, which is not for electricity, it's for heat and water. 12 foot by 4 foot. It's like 1.5 pieces of plywood and surface area. And that heat a lot of water. You can do a lot with hot water. You can, you know, move it and do all that. And basically, you can actually bring it up to that boiling point if you want as well. So that's a pretty cool thing there. But with that energy, you can sit there and create the light and everything that gives you your vitamin D and your vitamin E and A as well. But back off to the other point here. You said we'd just simply burn a log. We're talking about 50 years.
Yeah.
Still have... Up here in Alaska or in Upper Canada... Look, the snow melts, the trees gorge themselves with water, and then the cold drops in again. We're talking ice age, real cold, cold, cold.
Yeah.
And what happens? The outside water in the tree freezes, it makes it really hard, and then the inside freezes, and it expands, and the trees explode. Boom! How are you going to protect your plant life? That's basically what's it. If you don't have plant life, it's going to be hard for 50 years to be using compost heat.
You bring...
Because you don't have any plant material to compost.
You bring it all inside with you, man. Look.
It's going to take a lot of greenhouse. That is a very good answer.
All right. Well, science says that energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So no matter what it is, when we use it, it is recycled into the system. Whether it's burnt, whether it's whatever... Just like the explanation of the burning the firewood, you get more products out of the firewood that some would call waste products. The same thing would apply with any type of fuel that you're going to burn. You got hydrogen technology, oxygen, everything you need to build a self-contained system. As far as any of the known radiations out there, you got to understand that radiation isn't nothing more than a frequency wave out there. It's not some sort of, you know, like gamma radiation that Patty mentioned in there. You put a 2x4 board out there, and the guy well trained in martial arts will chop it in half. Yeah, you got two boards. You still got the same material. You still got the energy, but you just chopped it in half. It's no longer gamma radiation anymore. Yeah, the microwave, same thing. Chop it in half. Stretch it out. It's no longer a microwave anymore. And we have the technology to literally...
Gamma radiation.
Huh?
Now, gamma radiation.
Yeah. So, what uses can you use it for? Huh?
Heat.
Heat! There we go. That's what I'm trying to get to. We got back down to heat, and we got to cold. Hot and cold. Our two best friends. Or our two worst enemies. However you choose to look at it.
I know one thing, I'll tell you what. Like, you took your nature break a while ago. Well, maybe you should have been recycling that.
Maybe.
All our material that, you know, you eat material, if you just, you know, well, we're just going to bury it in one spot and never use it. It's not recycling. On a permaculture deal, they use every bit of it. They use your urine. They use everything into the compost. Heat the beds of the solar, of the greenhouses. Recycle it into the plants, and basically the plants create your the medicines that you need by what it's given.
So essentially what you just got through saying is what I've
everything
been saying for a long time.
Recycled. Everything needs to be taken in, nothing wasted. The number one deal is to preserve the plants.
What you just got through saying is what I've been shouting to everybody for years, is that all you had to do all along was mimic what nature does. Nature is a perfectly tuned Swiss watch.
That's because nature survived without us.
Yeah.
Long time.
But you just showed that, you know, utilizing, even in a closed-in system, utilizing everything from urine to, you know, composting and all that, you were able to recycle all that energy and all that material in the same system. So even if we were all in a big giant cave together, if we did...
I do that here.
Yeah? If we were...
I eat a doggone muskmelon or a cantaloupe, and I throw the seed in some more dirt. I throw... If it's starting to rot, I just throw it right on top of the compost, but I don't even turn it. I got plants, I have no idea what they are, growing out of the compost pile, and I still pile stuff on top. I don't care if it hits on top of a plant. Man, I got melons growing, I got maters growing, I got string beans growing, I got pinto beans growing. And the only thing I haven't put in there is corn, but you know what, corn makes a lot of compost, and you can do a lot with corn, man. I mean, you can build with corn stalk. All that stuff can be chopped up and done so much with. It's something else.
Well, you just answered your earlier deal right there, because if you grew corn alone, the husk could be used as firewood. And once you burn off the firewood, you get more material that could be utilized for fertilizer, that could be utilized...
Let's give it a lot of grace. You got 60 below temps, and you're burning a corn stalk. Let's give it a lot of grace and say we burned it a half hour. It's small enough; it didn't put a big enough, really big flame to they got the rocket stove mass heaters, you know, and you just take these long sticks and you just feed them down the tube, and it only burns at the end. And you can get 8 times the energy out of your wood. And instead of using 4 cords of wood, you've used a half a cord for the whole winter up north. And, so that's really great. But it goes into this, after it comes out of that main burn chamber and goes out there and you use it to heat the house straight off the top of the barrel, it goes back down and goes into the cob bench. which goes around maybe two walls of the house, which is actually the flue of the of that stove. It goes through there, and all that heat gets absorbed into that cob bench. You can put blankets on it. You can put plants on it. You can lay down on it and go to sleep and cover up and stay warm even after the stove has gone out for a long time. And but the thing is, see, you can touch it, and it's only warm. It's like that warm wall in the middle of summertime, and your air conditioner ain't keeping up. You can put your hand on that wall, but that mass, and basically the surface area of a lower warm temperature, will keep your house warm, even kicking as hard as it can, and it's using 3,600 watts. My goodness, that's horsepower. 746 watts is one horsepower. So if you're using 3,600 watts, oh my goodness, that's a lot of horsepower. Are you going to get that out of, it's got to be stuff like a rocket stove. It's got to be stuff that is very efficient.
Sure, that's what
it
I'm saying.
It can't be burned off and just expelled out in the atmosphere to go out into the cold.
In my plan, you use everything to its maximum efficiency, even the exhaust. They got right now a carbon dioxide scrubber. It is a device which absorbs carbon dioxide, CO2. It is used to treat exhaust gases from industrial plants from exhaled air in life support systems such as rebreathers or in spacecraft, submarine, submersible craft, and airtight chambers. So we could even...
burn the carbon monoxide as well. If you burn the carbon monoxide, you take the carbon out, and guess what? You have oxide. Or oxygen, and it's pure and breathable.
Well, there you go. Look, the science is there, folks.
You're just collecting the carbon out of it.
That's right. The science is there. You could build a perfectly efficient system that would allow you to be in a totally closed-in, airtight cylinder that is so insulated from the cold or the heat, whichever one it wanted to be. And you could get this system to literally be self-contained. We are standing right now in a self-contained biosphere, a thermoelectric generator of epic proportions. And that, I say thermoelectric because we have static electricity, we have lightning bolts, we have all kinds of different forms of electricity, and even the friction of the earth and the vibrations of everything going on, piezoelectrics, you name it, friction of the atmosphere rubbing up against the water, the friction of the atmosphere rubbing through the trees, and they're producing all kinds of energy. We are living in pure energy right now.
I know one easy way to scrub the carbon out of the carbon dioxide out. Now, if you let it get in, you know, put it into the form of water, you can take two carbon electrodes inside a jug and have them where they can. Where you can adjust the gap between them and make a spark gap. You take three car batteries, 12 volts each, making 36 volts, or a welder, whatever. If you got the energy, you can do this. So you get the arc going underneath the water. This, unlike HHO, which sometimes is called Brown's gas, unlike HHO, this makes Chantilly's gas, which has carbon monoxide in it, which will kill you. Okay, until you burn it. Now, when you burn it, basically you can breathe the gas that comes off it as you burn it because it's nothing but pure oxygen. Now, that's the fun thing. So you can burn this in the house. Matter of fact, you're gonna get dizzy because you got too much oxygen.
Yeah. Well, you know, they actually got oxygen therapy for making you healthier, so...
The exhaust is pure oxygen.
Well, there you go, man. So, folks, there's the ideas. Take the ideas however you want to take them. Take them as far as you want to take them. As a thought experiment that I'm trying right now with everybody and his brother, trying to give everybody exactly what it is that they asked for. Clean, renewable, alternative energy, free energy sources, whatever you want to call them.
You know what the best thing about that Chantilly's gas?
What?
When you're doing that, instead of waiting, they say 1.2 liters per minute. I'm telling you, you're getting 2 liters of gas per second.
Well, then you'll
a lot.
Then you'll have
more than enough oxygen. Now, if you had that down in the bottom of a cave or a mine where it caved in, you know what? If you could burn that down, then people could live down there indefinitely until they got rescued.
Sure, and if they're living inside basically a terrarium, it has its own biosphere inside there, and so
the water would still keep on turn. It would all eventually still turn into water, collect on the walls of the cave, drip down. You could sit there, collect it, and keep on reburning if they had the power down there.
Of course.
Energy.
Of course they got the power. They got the temperature difference outside, they got the temperature difference inside. Simple as that. Look, there's a thought experiment going on here at ShazizRadio.com. Come over here, click on that picture link that says thought experiment on there, and look at that, study it real well, and what you're looking at there is the equivalence of a battery, equivalence of a capacitor, a storage of heat and cold, and electricity, so you can take it as far as you want to go with it. Now, there's a whole lot of different other methods by which to get thermoelectrics. There's so many different options available. We got solar, we got wind, we got thermoelectrics, we got chemistry, we got seismic activity, everything under the sun. There's more energy on this planet than you could ever use in a trillion lifetimes until this sun stops doing what the sun does and the planet stops doing what the planet does. You will never, ever, 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 ever run out of fuel or energy. Period. Now, I don't care how brilliant you are out there, how many times or how many years you spend in school being a doggone scientist or a electrical engineer, and how many times you want to try to beat me over the head with the laws of physics and thermodynamics or all the different deals while you say certain things can't be done, I'm still going to say it. Energy is free, regardless of what you say or not. You can't deny it. We're sitting in right now a literally self-contained system that recycles everything. There ain't nothing that man has ever made that nature cannot take apart. Nature will dissolve it. If you're not using it, nature will take it away and put it back into the system. Now,
yeah, if it uses that energy, will grow abundantly and do it more prosperously.
That's right. You use it properly, you use it respectfully, you use it
it will become a balance.
That's right.
Don't balance.
Working
just like those doggone sand filters. You take a 55-gallon drum, you throw some big rocks down the bottom, some PVC with holes at the bottom. Then you throw some pea gravel, and then you throw a little bit of charcoal and some sand, and you run the sand all the way up to the top. The sun hits the top layer. You keep it wet where the water's just even with the sand on top. After a few weeks, it makes its own eco-culture.
Yep.
Which makes the bad bacteria weak because the sun's on it, which makes the strong, the good bacteria stronger, which eats the bad bacteria that are making the toxins and put vitamins and minerals into the water. And then it goes down through the dead zone where nothing lives, and it all filters out all the doggone shells and carcasses and all that stuff, gets down to the bottom. And you got nothing but pure, good, healthy drinking water coming out the bottom.
There you go.
And it's all a cycle, a balance. The sun hits the top, strengthens the good bacteria, and keep on getting fed with the bad bacteria and everything else that you want to filter out. That good bacteria just keeps on purifying it for you. And it keeps you alive so you can keep feeding.
That's right.
That's a balance.
That's right.
It happens naturally.
Is anybody paying nature right now?
Nope.
Then nature has given you a gift of free energy. Period. No ifs, ands, or buts. No dispute. Didn't cost you nothing to walk around on this planet. Didn't cost you anything for the oxygen you breathe. It didn't cost you nothing for the sunburn you got from being out in the sun too long. Didn't cost you nothing from the wind burn you got from being out in the wind too long. Didn't cost you nothing for the water that you drank. It didn't cost you nothing, period. Nature has provided all the free energy you could use for your entire lifetime, your children's entire lifetime, your grandchildren's, and to infinity and beyond. If we learn how to work in perfect harmony with nature, we got every single answer resolved. When this world is ready to take the next level in real science, tell them to contact us at shazizradio.com and we'll sit down and explain to them in graphic detail the simplicity of working in perfect harmony with nature and giving them exactly what it is that our government said they wanted, people around the world said that they wanted: clean, renewable, alternative energy, getting us away from the so-called fossil fuel, which is a misnomer. Nonetheless, you're never going to run out of oil. It's not possible. As long as the Earth has the same chemistry, there will always be crude oil on this planet. All right? You're never, ever, ever, ever going to run out of what you like to call fossil fuel. It's not possible.
If we stop polluting the planet and give it what it needs, it will cure everything, even us. Just like, let's say, cannabis, man. Okay, you don't smoke it and get a buzz. Oh, hey, big deal. You know, that ain't what, you know, it ain't all what it's about. If you eat cannabis, you put it in a blender and just grind it up. You eat the cannabis, the deal is it won't get you a buzz. It won't get you a buzz at all, but it'll darn near cure everything in your body. And if you plant it where you've had nuclear fallout, it absorbs all of that and takes care of that as well. If we just give the planet a break and let it heal itself, it'll heal us.
That's right. All we've got to do is work in perfect harmony with it and
give it what it needs and stop.
We'll be fine. But anyway, back to the whole deal about never running out of oil. You're never going to run out of water. You're never going to run out of food. You're never going to run out of anything you need to survive. The only thing that you're going to end up doing is, like the old fishbowl concept, peeing and pooing in your own fishbowl until it's uncomfortable and even unhealthy for you to live in. And eventually, you know, nature will get rid of you and keep the fishbowl and clean it up. So if you want to learn how to do clean, renewable, alternative energy once and for all, if you want to learn how to get completely off the power grid once and for all, if you want to learn how to work in perfect harmony with nature using what real science teaches and real physics, then come over here to shazizradio.com and join us on the show and let's discuss and let's enact the solutions that have been on the table since way back to the beginning of recorded history.
Right.
So, there you go. Somebody send a copy of this podcast to the President of the United States and to all the different diplomats of the United Nations and let them hear what I have to say. This isn't no magical hoodoo, voodoo version. This is, you know, you got to put a little effort towards it. But using common sense and basic science and basic physics and things efficiently, there is no reason under the sun that we can't take this world to the next level of human existence and work in perfect harmony with one another and nature. If you're ready to do so, Shaziz Radio and all its crew and all its listeners and all the people interested in free energy out there are ready to assist you in that endeavor. And if you're waiting around for doomsday, such as global warming, to cause catastrophic weather throughout the entire globe and wipe us all off the map, and you want to wait till the last minute to say, oh, things are bad enough now, let's go ahead and listen to Shaziz Radio. Don't even bother. Don't even waste our time. Now we're going to have to run around like chickens with our head cut off to try to repair hundreds of years worth of stupidity when we should have been doing it all along. We can build houses that the wind can't blow over. We can build houses that the water can't sink. We can build indestructible deals that would work in perfect harmony with nature. We can build perfect food systems, perfect waste systems, everything being perfectly recycled, 100% efficiency out there. They say there ain't no way to get 100% efficiency, and that is because they have not, and I repeat, have not paid attention to nature. I have. I paid attention in school. I'm paying attention right now, and I'm waiting for the Dream Team to show up. When the Dream Team shows up, we're going to put everything together, and we're going to show you how it's done. Okay? That's it. So send a copy of this to the presidents and the leaders of the world and tell them, look, if you guys really are serious and you're not in it for the money and you want to really save humanity, these are the folks that are pointing out the folks and the technology to do just that. Peace and love to everybody. You've been listening to the Mad Science Show, and thank you very much, Muddy. Take care, buddy.
Yeah, no problem. Vote for Shaziz. Make a difference.
Yeah. Shaziz for president.
We need 3.6 billion votes.
All I need is a voice. All I need...
$1 per vote.
All I need is a voice and the ears to hear the common sense, and I think we can motivate each other to get things done. You know...
If you vote with $1 and we get 3.6 billion votes, then... It doesn't matter what government does anyway, we'll take over.
Yeah, we'll just build
it
ourselves.
And we'll have all the green energy set up for you. Cross our heart, because we'll have the money to do so.
All right, we got to go, folks.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.